and good. And he's launching a new renewal program in his school, which is basically a higher level program. And Jeff, all things being equal, should be turning his, you know, turning his school into a $400,000 or $500,000 a year school next year, by, you know, sort of like strategically launching these types of things. So I'm gonna go ahead and bleep out some of the background here. Okay, good. I've got everybody muted for now. It's we started to get a little bit of echo there. Look, I've got three or four things to accomplish here real quick with everybody, and I wanted to sort of retell an interesting conversation I had this afternoon with Ron Ipack, a good friend of ours. And Master, we are lucky enough to have Master Oliver joining us here in just a few moments as well. But let me do just two or three quick housekeeping items. Right now, everyone is muted. And later on, in about 30 or 40 minutes here, we're going to open up for Q&A. And you'll unmute yourself at that time by hitting the number 6 on your phone. You don't need to hit any stars or anything like that. We're on that new bridge. So right now you are muted. We've got callers from all over the place. I've got a couple of international prefixes, a +61, which is Australia. So we've got a couple of guys from Australia, which is one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. So before Master Oliver jumps in, and we have a lot to talk about with him today, before that happens, there are let me tell you about one disturbing thing that's happened in the industry that you're going to be hearing about very soon here, and I shudder to make a recommendation on this, so I'll abstain for a minute, but you're going to hear about a couple of billing companies who have become insolvent, and this affects you directly, our dear friend who's called in from Australia. You know, with the challenge in the economy, people are, you know, scared, and they're really you know, in a psychological quagmire in many cases about some things. We are seeing some, you know, obviously we've seen the trend happen in the industry, and we're going to talk a lot about that today, but one thing that you're going to see, and I don't want anybody to panic, but one thing that you're going to see is there are a couple of relatively well-known billing companies, one in Australia and one in the United Kingdom, who have gone out of business. And unfortunately, when that happens, any collections, any cash that's in the company goes with it into bankruptcy protection. So I don't want to disclose the name today. I'll wait for a second opinion on that, perhaps in a few moments. But you're going to see a couple of stories about that pretty quickly here. So if you're in Australia, this is something that, you know, may not affect you directly, but you'll hear about. And if you're in UK, you'll hear a little bit about that. Now, what's happened here is both of these cases are not directly solely fallout from the quote recession. In fact, they're both cases of lawsuits, of challenges that affected the company external from their customer relationships, meaning they had plenty of customers that were billing with them, they had plenty of people that were you know, able to finance the company, there was plenty of revenue, but there were external factors that happened. So just to make a long story short, I'm not going to make a recommendation here. But I'm going to tell you a quick story about, of course, one of my favorite human beings, Dan Kennedy, and his one of the chapters in his No BS Ruthless Management book, and one of the chapters in his No BS Business Success book is called The Worst Number in Business. And the worst number in business is one, meaning anything, you know, any component of your business, any factor of your business that is a number one, it sucks. Meaning any one key employee that you depend 100% on, any one key vendor that you depend 100% on, any one of anything sucks. Because as Dan describes later on in the chapter, they all go lame. At some point or another, your one key primary thing is going to go, you know, wheels up, right? It's going to go belly up. Not necessarily bankruptcy, but, you know, you're always going to have, if you allow yourself to be hamstrung by one key factor, and that key factor goes away, you're done. So let's talk about that in the marketing context. We've had this happen. Master Oliver's had this happen in Denver a few times. I had this happen to me in Florida. We're heavy advertisers in both of our local Yellow Pages and the regional Yellow Page. So there were three Yellow Pages that we had ads in this area down here in Florida. And well, what happened was the Yellow Books all consolidated, right? So then we had, instead of three costing us, you know, a few hundred a month, we had only one Yellow Book that wanted to charge us $2,000 a month for the same ad. See, now if that was our primary lead generator, right? If that was the big pillar that held up the roof of our house, and that thing went away, or became too expensive, or became too, the cost became untenable, then we're out of business, right? So if my only new customer acquisition channel was Yellow Pages, and these three Yellow Books consolidated, I'm done, right? And Dan and Jay Abraham both call this, you know, the power Parthenon of geometric business growth. They call it the marketing Parthenon. If you have only one pillar that holds up your roof, you're very susceptible to difficult times, to challenges with that one pillar. And Dan calls it the difference between the diving board approach to marketing and the Parthenon approach to marketing, right? And I know you've all, if you've been a member for any amount of time, you've heard me describe that over and over and over again, so I won't bore you with details on that today. But anyway, so what does that mean in this context? Well, in this context, my personal opinion is, I don't think I'd want to have all my eggs in one basket right now. If there's a way that I could have multiple companies handling those collections for me, I think I would do that. God forbid you had all your eggs in one basket and something bad happens to them, right? I would also probably have my billing remitted to me very, very frequently rather than infrequently. This is something that you're going to be hearing about it. It's something that's real in the industry. And it's something that, you know, I think you should take proactive steps to help your school with. The second thing that is directly related to that topic is I just had a great conversation today with a really good friend of ours. Master Oliver's known him for years and years and years. He's part of Dan Kennedy's Platinum Group as well, Von iPad. And if you were at the Quantum Leap, the NAPMA Quantum Leap last year in Denver, Ron was one of our guest speakers there, and Ron was actually, he was on first thing in the morning on Saturday morning, and he was talking about the Lazy Man's Way to Riches, if you remember that. He got into a straitjacket on stage, and very entertaining guy, very, very, very sharp individual. And what he does, basically, is he runs a company that is very much like the NAPMA for auto repair store owners. And basically, his company helps auto repair store owners market their businesses, acquire new customers, serve their customers at a higher level than many expect, retain customers better, you know, those types of things. So it's very, very, very much the same as what NAPMA helps martial arts school owners do. Anyway, I was just having a conversation with him this afternoon about a couple of different things, and I asked him, I said, you know, Ron, you know, other than what we all know, you know, how is the auto repair industry doing? You know, how exactly is that going? Because, you know, I thought since there weren't a lot of new cars being sold right now, that people would be fixing up their old cars more than they would be just going out and buying new ones, right? So Ron said something interesting, which is what we've been saying for at least 2 years during this economic transition. And we've been shouting it from the rooftops and hoping that you all would listen. And I know if you're on this call, you have listened. But an awful lot of folks haven't. And here's what's happening in the auto repair industry. This is what Ron's description to me was. He said, well, Toby, you know, the chasm is widening. The distance between the successful shop owners and the struggling shop owners is getting wider and wider and wider and farther and farther. Those who are paying attention and who are learning how to acquire new customers, learning how to serve their customers better, learning how to retain customers, to generate referrals, those who are doing that actively are doing better and better and better. Those who aren't learning how to do that, those who aren't implementing, those who aren't changing their business strategies are going out of business in droves, and they're struggling and struggling and dying. And that's exactly what's happening in the martial arts industry. We're seeing a very wide gap appearing, and there are a few folks at the bottom of the spectrum who are teaching out of their basement or who are teaching, you know, in rec centers who have no rent or expense structure to speak of, and they teach as a hobby, and for them it's a pastime, not a career. And, you know, they're not really going anywhere because, you know, they really don't have any expenses, nor do they really have any revenue to speak of. So, you know, they're just kind of hanging out, doing what they've always done. Then there's the guys at the top of the industry who are running very successful commercial school operations, who have staff members, professional staff, who are trained, who are educated, who, you know, who really go out and make it happen. And they're doing better and better and better and better as long as they're paying attention to their marketing and they're acquiring new customers. And then the guys in the middle are the ones who are really getting squeezed. The guys who are at, you know, $3,000-$5,000 a month, $7,000-$9,000 a month, $10,000-$12,000 a month, who have a commercial location, who have rent, they have expenses, they might even have a staff member or two that they're paying, they have, you know, a Yellow Page bill and they have utility bills. Those are the guys who are really struggling because their market, their piece of the market is shrinking. They're attracting customers of lower, quote, quality, not to make a value judgment about a customer or a student, but they're attracting customers who are first and most affected by economic challenges, rather than the top end of the market, the you know, our inner circle members and our peak performer members, who are attracting the top piece of the market, those customers who are least and last affected by economic challenges and economic downturns. So we're seeing this very wide chasm appear not only in the martial arts industry, but in many, 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 many other industries. And Master Oliver, I see you're on with this. Did you have maybe a perspective on that you'd like to share with us? Or I know Ron had a pretty entertaining way of describing it to me this afternoon, but we're certainly seeing it in spades with all the things that we're doing inside the martial arts industry.
Well, yeah, I mean, what you're saying goes back to, you know, about 15 months ago at the Extreme Success Academy when I annoyed quite a few people by saying that it was going to be a year of the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And of course, what I mean by that is I don't mean people who are billionaires that happen to own a martial arts school. What I mean by rich is those who are willing to invest in their own training and then are willing to go and immediately implement. So, you know, those who I'm defining rich in the martial arts industry are truly the guys who figure out what their business is all about, focus on it appropriately, and take action. And I think what you're hearing from Ron and his business, but also, you know, all of the people that we deal with who deal in similar niches have the same story. Those who are either ignorant, in other words, they don't seek out knowledge, or those who seek out knowledge in an empty way and don't take action are either suffering slow and painful death or are imploding quickly, and more likely imploding quickly this year.
Yeah, and you know, maybe the last piece of you know, content in this area that I'd like to share was, you know, I frequent as many of the industry forums and things like that all around the martial arts industry as I humanly can. And there's been sort of like this kind of a thread of dialogue that I know happens psychologically with business owners when times get tough. And it certainly deserves to be addressed today and before we transition into our, you know, thinking about the New Year marketing plan. Three or four school owners in the last few days I've had direct conversations with, either by email or by discussion or on the telephone. And they're sort of defaulting to the sort of like the financial fetal position, I guess. And they're kind of going back to saying to themselves, well, look, I see schools around me crumbling and falling, and I see that, you know, my bottom line doesn't look as pretty as it looked, you know, 10 months ago. Maybe I should now become a discounter. Maybe I should lower my rates, and I should now be the cheapest alternative in town so that I can scoop up more market share, put more students into the school, and ensure my own survival. And my analogy on this is, you know, trying to choose to be the Walmart of the martial arts industry. And choosing to be Walmart, you know, number one, can't work in our business because we're never going to be able to attract as many customers as Walmart can attract. But secondarily, being if you live by price, you die by price. And the problem with being a discounter, one of the problems with being a discounter is that there's always going to be somebody behind you willing to charge less. You're never going to be able to maintain being the cheapest. And there's a myriad of other problems that go along with this, but maybe you have a different perspective on this. I just think it's extremely dangerous thinking to think that just because we're moving through an economic challenge, that lowering your rates is the right way to go about this.
Yeah, you know, and Toby, one of the things that we want to do today, and we certainly don't want to run out of time to do it, is really the 10 things that everybody needs to implement for 2010 to be successful. And you mentioned the pricing deal, and I had shared an article with you. I think I even put it up on Facebook. Anybody who's on the call who's not on my Facebook, you probably want to do that because I share a lot of interesting things like that are useful for school owners. But it was an article from Business Week. I guess I should tell them how to do that. Go to facebook.com/ Stephen Oliver, StephenOliver, until we max that one out. But the article was about Apple Computer. And, you know, I can tell you I've become, you know, raging thunder lizard evangelist for Apple. And always have been an enthusiast of Steve Jobs since the early days of watching Apple. But the article was about this. It said that, Toby, if you remember the number, but it said that Apple has, I think it was 87% market share of computers over $1,000, which is
It was 89%. So I mean, even better.
yeah, and they have a relatively substantial share, meaning I think 36 or 37%. I'm not looking at the article in front of me, but a fairly substantial share of laptops generally, which is becoming there's a lot more laptops sold now than desktops. The inflection point was a couple years ago. But the share of market of PCs or of computers, I guess you can't say PCs or their Macs, of computers over $1,000 having that high a market share. And what the article went on to say is it talked about the fact that Compaq, which is of course now part of HP, and so Compaq and HP, Toshiba, Dell, that all of the main PC manufacturers are all living on tiny margins and really have gotten themselves into a situation where they're really all selling a generic commodity. Mm-hmm. And Apple has gone the opposite direction, which is, you know, desktops with arguably comparable capabilities of as far as processing speed and so forth, for $2,000 that somebody else might be selling for $700. But theirs are sexy and they're desirable and they have, additional features and value. But the most important part of the article is not that. The most important part of the article is that Apple, in this third and fourth quarter, have all-time record profits in an otherwise down year, where Dell and HP and all of the others are really suffering this year. So it's a lesson in where do you want to be? Do you want to be at the high end of the market, or do you want to be at the bottom end of the market?
Yeah, another piece of that statistic, by the way, that was interesting was that Apple only had, I think it was like 12% of the overall computer market, mm-hmm. but of the over $1,000 ones, they were 89%. So I mean, they had a tiny market share of the overall market, but they had a huge share of those premium customers. And that's exactly what, you know, we should all be thinking, because we are never going to be HP, Dell, or Compaq. We're not going to have. Look, as best as any of us can calculate, and this is using some kind of algorithms that are pretty complicated, as best as we can calculate, market penetration for martial arts schools in North America is somewhere between 6 and 8%. Meaning of all the qualified prospects that we have in our communities, we only have between 6 and 8% of them training in martial arts. Our real competition is dance, soccer, baseball, gymnastics. They have a much bigger market share than we do. Well, we don't have to worry about having a huge share of the total market. We just have to worry about having a significant share of the premium market. They're much easier to go attract, and they're much easier to retain as well. So, I mean, it's
well, and I would say it even differently than the way you just said it, Toby, is I don't think there is a distinction in our market. What the distinction in our market is, I mean, think about this. You think about, you know, you read that in the recession that Walmart is doing extremely well. And so it leads you to think that, you know, discounting is the way to go. And then you look at the fact that that Apple's doing extremely well at the high end of the market, and then it's a confusing message. But here's the way I think of martial arts schools, is you go get them in a vacuum. In other words, when Jody goes shopping today, she's going to know that we need milk for our 18-month-old, and we need, you know, cheese, and we need toilet paper and whatever other things it is. And she may decide to go to the place where she thinks she can get a Procter & Gamble product and a, you know, Windex and whatever else it might be at the lowest price. But see, martial arts schools aren't like that. People don't make a decision that way. We go get to them. We entice them into the idea that this is something useful for us. And then we get them in, and then they make a decision of, do I want to do this or do I not want to do this? And then after they make that decision, they make a decision of, can I afford this or can I not afford this? So the decision-making process is completely different with us. And is it true that a portion of the market that are in martial arts lessons cannot afford $200, $300, $400, $500, $600 a month for lessons? Sure. It is true of that. However, at a certain price point, most of the people you're going to go out and get will be able to afford it, and if you provide a high enough quality service, will be willing to afford it. And a fair number of them, really the next level down, a lot of them are, you know, must go to a rec center at $40 a month. It's not that if, you know, the difference between 120 a month and 200 a month makes much difference. So, you know, I think we've got to keep that in mind as you evaluate what we're doing as well.
Yeah, no, and in reality, that really is the crux of this argument. There really is no commoditization of our thing yet. Now, MMA is trying to do a pretty good job of that with the type of TV coverage it gets, but it's still always going to be a personality-driven deal when you sit down with a prospect. Now, the other piece of that, by the way, is you know, Dan talks about in this Renegade Millionaire series, he talks about the non-commoditization of commodities. So even if you think you are a commodity, even if that's what you think, even if for some reason you're under this misguided misrepresentation that you think all martial arts has to be $40 a month, walk into your grocery store today and look around, and you're going to see lettuce that's, you know, I don't know how much lettuce is, $2 a head, right? And then an aisle down or a few feet down, you're going to see organic lettuce that's grown on the sunny side of a mountain in California that's only fed with, you know, manure from cows that are hand massaged and fed beer, right? And you know, the super duper lettuce. And that's going to be $4 a head or $5 a head or $10 a head, right? So even in commodities, even in things that are commoditized, there's a way to decommoditize yourself. And we're not in that situation, but if that's the case, then we certainly have an opportunity to stake out a position in a market rather than allow the market to position us.
Well, here's the only way you could make that opposite argument. If you went back to, and some people still think this way about their school, even though it doesn't exist right now, but if I were to go back to the days of Karate Kid and look at the fact that it was kind of like the early days of Taibo, where lots of people were running to the Yellow Pages looking for karate lessons because they had gone to Karate Kid, and there was this general buzz among parents and the general buzz among kids, and they were now going through the phone book calling various schools and trying to compare various schools. See, you would have to say that you're in that kind of market to begin with, where people are seeking us out rather than we're having to go get them. Mm-hmm. And honestly, we're not in a market where people are seeking us out. We're in a market where we're having to go get them in almost all cases. And if we're in a market where we have to go get them, what we want to be doing, in fact, frankly, in that other market, I always try to be there anyway, too, but we want to be in the marketing in a vacuum. And they come in and they decide they like us or don't like us. They can decide they can afford it or can't afford it. And then only if they like the activity but can't afford us, do they ever think about that there might be other people providing the service in the market. Mm-hmm. See, that's what you've got to keep in mind with this, is that, you know, we're not in the situation where most of your students are coming because generically they were looking for karate lessons for their kids or martial arts lessons, and then they were comparing five providers. That's just not the market we're in right now. So therefore, thinking that assumes that is erroneous. But anyway, Toby, before we spend too much time, obviously, if we're going to create a list of the top 10 things that you have to do in 2010 to be successful, we would, I think, both put starting on the list is be at the upper end of the tuition scale. And let's give them some thoughts on what that would be. If you were thinking of anywhere in, let's say, the United States, of course, I really think Europe and most of the rest of the world is similar, but anywhere in the United States, how much do you want to be charging a new student to take martial arts lessons?
Well, I mean, in my personal opinion, you need to be around the $200 mark. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, probably the national average is perhaps just over 100, but in reality, you'd want to be about double that. I mean, I don't want to say barometer, but if you wanted to do market research on this, I mean, I would compare us closer to Huntington Learning Center in Sylvan rather than the dance school down the street. But I actually just did stumble across, by the way, we're doing some work with Charles Dudley in Texas, and there's some legislation happening down there that we're paying close attention to, and there's a very tight association of cheerleading schools, and the average tuition, everybody freaking buckle your seatbelt on this one, the average revenue per student in the competitive gymnastics world is $360 per month. Okay, so do the math on that. The average, not extreme examples. The average in competitive gymnastics, and this is cheerleading, which is like, you know, probably the worst social experiment we've done in recent years. But the average tuition is almost double what, actually triple or quadruple what the average martial arts school tuition is. So just consider that for a minute. But my personal opinion is you got to be around $200 a month for a new enrollment.
Yeah. Well, our where we're going to go to for the Mile High Karate Schools January 1st is in round numbers, about $500 down, $247 a month for an enrollment. And then just double that number for a family enrollment. And then what we're going to move to, and right now we're doing $259 a month for Master Club, $359 for Leadership. We're basically going to move to $497 for Leadership. So now you can make a very good economics-based argument for, this is not necessarily the right time and place to be doing across-the-board price increases. However, for most of the schools in NABNA, they haven't come anywhere near being at the type of price points that they should be. So, so the number one thing, and again, if you look at the past 18 months, it hasn't been the guys who are charging $200 a month that have been imploding. It's been the guys who are charging $47 a month. And, I've talked to several school owners who on one side had done a pretty good job. They had 200 or 300 active students. I talked to one guy who had 300 active students, was grossing $9,000 a month. Well, that's a way to ensure yourself a route to oblivion. Because with that many students, you have a fair amount of activity and a fair amount of headaches and a fair amount of staff you need and so forth, and you just can't support it on $9,000 a month. That 300 active students, my rule of thumb is, worst case, I'd want to be at $60,000 a month, and I'd prefer to be closer to 100. So it really makes a huge difference in your bottom line. So Toby, if we were going to say the number one thing you have to do for the new year, to be successful, obviously one of them is be at a proper tuition price point, which for most people means quite a bit higher than where they're at now.
Perhaps, Mr. Oliver, there might be something that we should psychologically prepare everybody for. And I was just listening to Lloyd Irvin the other day. Actually, he was talking about your boot camp five years ago or six years ago. And I had the opportunity to talk to him, and Lloyd said, you know, one of the things that made the biggest impact on him and to really catapult him farther forward than he had ever thought was possible was you asked him at boot camp, Lloyd, let me ask you a question. When you do enrollments, how many people are objecting about the price? And he said, well, none. Nobody ever objects about it. They just sign up. Well, see, you know that you've got a problem there, right? You know that you're dramatically undercharging for your service. Until you get about, I don't know, what is it, 20% or 25% of the people who say, well, it's just so expensive, I can't afford it. That's perhaps a good barometer. So you should be prepared to have that conversation with potential students. It's okay if they can't afford it. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. And if you decide that you want to work with them in one way or another, that's a whole other animal. But the real thing here is there's all sorts of opportunity on the table. If no one is objecting about the price, you're dramatically undercharging, right?
Well, and I'll say it even differently. I had a coaching client for a long time in Coronado, which is suburban San Diego. You know, it's Coronado Island where they have SEAL team training and aircraft carriers and fairly upscale neighborhood. And when we started working together, basically the first thing I had him do was double his prices across the board. And he did it to his to his credit. And we talked a month later, and he was all freaked out. And he was freaked out because about a third of the people that he talked to didn't do the renewal or didn't do the enrollment, and they quoted the fact that it was because they couldn't afford it. And I asked him a question, which he hadn't thought of, is I said, well, okay, before when you were asking, let's say, 10 people a month to do the renewal, what percentage of them didn't do it and quoted price was the reason? Well, it turned out the ratio was the same. The ratio hadn't changed. But in his mind, he was sensitive to the price point because he had just raised it. So now when somebody brought that up as the objection, he was paying attention to it. Before, when somebody brought that up, it wasn't the first thing that was on his mind. And so you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, in my mind, you want to develop your introductory process and your marketing materials and so forth so that when somebody comes in and you tell them the price, that the reaction is, wow, that's great. I thought it was going to be more expensive. The truth is, if I were to go into one of our schools today, and I probably will in the next month or two, and do 30 or 40 or 50 enrollment conferences, my guess is 80% of them are going to, you know, swallow hard and wipe the sweat from their brow and have a serious chat with the kid when price is mentioned, because it is enough to make them think about it. And so when it's at the right point, a fair number of people, you know, sit up and take note when you tell them the price, and probably you're going to have 20-25% who can't do it because they can't afford it. And you're probably going to have 15-20% that you really need to kind of walk them through it smoothly so that they're comfortable with it. However, my argument has always been is that, you know, the next price down where you get everybody who can do it is way too low a price for us to consider. And by the way, you can make the opposite argument. Is we talked about a school that we went to in San Antonio when we were there. It's a Krav Maga based school, but really it's a big fitness center with a kind of a Krav Maga marketing angle. And they have a starting price point of $29 a month. Well, the reason for their price point is everybody can do it, and when they stop taking classes, they don't cancel the contract. It's the fitness center pricing model. If I'm getting hit on my credit card for $29 a month or my checking account for $29 a month and I haven't been there for 6 months, I don't bother canceling it. However, if I'm getting hit for $249 a month and I haven't been there for a couple of months, I think real seriously about canceling it or doing something with it. So you can make the opposite argument. I just think that in almost all cases, it's a dead bang loser going that direction.
Yeah, you know, there's one other factor of this, without like killing this to death. There's one other factor that I remember. Listening to Jay Abraham when he talked about doing his private consultations with, you know, some of the Fortune 1000 that he's worked with, and he always said when he pushed the paper across the table to the executive who was making the decision about whether to hire him or not, if the guy across the table just immediately grabbed the checkbook and said you got it and wrote him a check and handed it to him, he always thought to himself, damn, that was a mistake. Not only because he felt that he could have got more money, right? Although that is one factor. The other factor is the guy who just wrote a check without thinking about it, he didn't take Jay very seriously. And he probably wasn't going to do every little thing Jay told him to do. So he knew that his advice would be less effective for him in the long run because he didn't respect it enough or he didn't think about it hard enough to really be committed to the process. And it's exactly the same in a martial arts school. If you have your school filled with people who, you know, paying $30, $40, $50 a month and don't really care about that money, then, you know, really they're not really telling you much. They're not telling you that they really care about your lessons very much. They're probably not as committed of a student as they would be if they had to pay an amount that really made them think about. And then the other piece of that is, you know, how much you're actually delivering to the student. That's a whole other animal. But
yeah, well,
I think it's a good lesson. If they're not taking it seriously, they're not taking it seriously.
Well, and we probably beat this point to death. But I will tell you, as you elevate your tuition points, what will happen is you'll have more serious students. They'll complain less often about less things. They'll be more likely to comply and do what you ask them to do, so therefore they'll be much more likely to be successful at what you want them to do and what you want them to accomplish. And so all kinds of good things happen. At a higher price point, your retention is better. At a higher price point, they complain less. At a higher price point, you have, frankly, less hand-holding that you need to do. At a higher price point, you have a higher follow-through to black belt. So, you know, all kinds of good things happen where at a lower price point, and part of it is not just lower price points, but when you become flexible and negotiable in the rates and start bending to people's whims, as you do that, all kinds of bad things happen because it's just predispositioning the students to, frankly, to be an uncooperative client. So you want to be very careful not to set yourself up for that. Well, let's go to at least three or four more points of the top 10 things you want to do to be successful in 2010 here, Mr. Milroy. And I would say the number two thing, now that we've discussed price, is the number two thing is to really evaluate the student experience and to make sure that from the standpoint of the student, not from the standpoint of a fifth degree black belt or whatever, master instructor in Taekwondo or Jiu-Jitsu, but from the standpoint of the student and the standpoint from the parent of the student, that you really dramatically increase the quality of the program, meaning the quality of the curriculum, but also the quality of the experience that they have with your school for the new year. So you really need to go and look at, one is, what can I do to have a higher quality of rapport with my students? What can I do to have the pacing and the chunking and the structure of the classes be better and more appropriate? What can I do to have the curriculum received better and be more exciting for the students as they come in? What can I do from the standpoint of the parents to have them perceive the value and the quality of the school at a higher level? So it's all the way through really spending a lot of time, and I would say the time from Christmas to New Year's is a good time to sit down with a blank legal pad and maybe do some surveys of your students and the parents. You got to be a little careful about how you go about that, but do some surveys and do some evaluations and really think for yourself, how do I have a higher level of quality rapport with my students? How do I have a higher level of service from the perception of the parents? How do I really make sure that at every step of the way that we're elevating the experience of the students and the quality of the program from the perception of the customer? What would you add to that, Mr. Milroy?
Well, you know, I it's back to our pricing discussion too, but in reality, the only people that I've seen in this industry who have been outrageously successful over time, being premium priced options, et cetera, are the ones who bring overwhelming service. And you know, our mantra, you know, I guess the NAPMA / Mile Like Ride mantra is we want to provide $5 in service for every dollar in tuition we charge.
Yeah.
And I was having this, again, this discussion with this associate who's charging $40 a month and thinks it's too much money. Well, look, we spend more than $40 a month per student on our students, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, what school are they going to have a better experience with? So I agree with you. I think if I were to make a bullet point list, I would think about how I can leverage all the media at my disposal for my students' benefit, meaning websites, teleconferences, webinars, direct mail, and anything I can do to anchor that student relationship in with the school. And how do I really, and again, if you're an ATMA member, you should be sending that for you student newsletter to your students every month.
Mm-hmm.
You should be plugging your instructors into the virtual classroom every week. If you're an ATMA member, you know you can log into the member section. We have that virtual classroom every week that gives you new exciting drills to be teaching in class. The words of the week you could be teaching in class, the gold team drills, all those types of things that you can be doing in class. So we're really here to make your life easier on this, and that's what you, that's where this starts. It starts with what you do in the classroom, but where you really need to take this, if you want to be, you know, at the top of this heap, is what are you doing outside the classroom to reinforce what you're doing inside the classroom? What are you doing to bring the families in, you know, to be engaged in the process and all that sort of stuff? So I think the place to start is look at what the floor looks like, but don't just stop there. That's where too many school owners stop. They stop when it's time for the students to walk out the door. And I think in reality, if we really are trying to do what we say we're trying to do, then the students have to be living, breathing examples of what they learn in the classroom outside of the classroom. So how you reinforce that, I think, is a big part of this.
Yeah. Well, you know, keep in mind that the number one criteria that people use on whether they have a good experience or a bad experience with you is all of the indicators of whether you really care about them as an individual or not. So it's all types of just personal touches with human beings. And so the first place to start is taking pictures of all of the beginner students, using them as flashcards for the staff, for kids, take a picture with the parents, have everyone on your staff know, I mean, and I'm talking about your black belts, your leadership team, your assistant instructors, your head instructors, have everyone in your school know that they're required to know everybody's name, and every time a person is in the school, they use that name 3 or 4 times in the interaction. The other way that that people judge whether you really care about them or not is human contact. I mean, actual touching. And, you know, shaking hands is good. A warm, friendly hand on the shoulder and a discussion about how their weekend went is better. And an appropriate touch in class, adjusting their leg or their arm or their punch or their kick when they're in class is necessary. So you really want to be having each of your staff members know that every time a student's in class, you know, 3 times they're using their name and 3 times they're actually appropriately physically touching them. And just those two little movements make a big difference. And then what so many times we've done is we've created what we as a martial artist think of as a quality class and a quality curriculum, without stopping to think of mom who's uneducated in martial arts but pretty sensitive to their kids' enjoyment and pacing and level of recognition, that it may not be what that mom perceives as high quality or what the, you know, the 8 or 9 year old in class perceives as high quality, and really their opinion is the only one that counts. I mean, the the person writing the check is the one who gets to have an opinion of whether you're providing a high quality service or not. So that's my number two. What's your number three, Mr. Milroy, of things you absolutely have to do in the new year to be extremely successful?
Well, I mean, you have to continue to expand your marketing Parthenon. I mean, whatever you're doing today to attract new students, you have to do more of those things, you know. Not necessarily more of the same things, perhaps more different things. So right now I'm attracting all of my students each and every month from, you know, an internal referral activity, a yellow page ad, and a website. Then that's only three. You should have at least six next year, right? You should be doing at least, you know, 6, 10, 12 things each and every month to acquire a couple of students each. So you have to continue to expand that marketing Parthenon. And whatever you're comfortable with now isn't what you need to be good at next year. You have to be comfortable with two things. So if I'm not very good at using direct mail, I need to get very good at using direct mail. If I'm not very good at internet, I need to get very good at internet. If I'm not very good at, you know, referral programs, if I'm doing referral programs in my school and they're not working, I need to fix that. I need to get good at those things. So I would think you need to expand your comfort level with your marketing activity so that you're acquiring students through new customer acquisition channels.
Yeah. And part of what, over and over again, if you take the top 5% of the industry and compare them with the bottom 80%, is the bottom 80% or the top 5%, and it's again, I hate to be simplistic, but they're just doing more stuff. They're sitting down with the blank legal pad and putting together the 20 different things they're going to do this month to generate new students, and are consistently and repetitiously implementing it. You know, Jay Abraham talks about whether your marketing is an event or whether it's an ongoing and consistent thing that you're doing. And if you're not doing 10, 15, 20 different things each and every month forever to generate new students, you're missing the boat. And on the other way of thinking about it is, everything you're doing is designed to generate a lead, and then you want to be following up with those leads. And I would prefer weekly, but at least monthly forever. So, you know, one of the best things I did, 10, 15 years ago in learning how to market was I ended up on Jay Abraham's list after having gone to a $5,000 seminar. And it was interesting to me that almost every week I was getting a package from him that must have been $3, $4, $5 to put in the mail, and that continued for years. And obviously, the value of a customer to him is, I mean, it was, you know, he already knew I had been to a $5,000 seminar, so you know he could probably sell me the $25,000 thing next. But it was just a consistent and never-ending and repetitious thing. And in all likelihood, they had thought about it for a year or two out on what was going to hit, and it just was like clockwork. And so many times we get a lead, they come into a party or something like that, they don't enroll this month, we forget about them, and we've had a lot of I know in our schools here in Denver, a lot of students who were first introduced to us 3 or 4 years ago, who just finally got around to taking the plunge after being, you know, barraged for that period of time. So and again, it's not terribly expensive. A postcard in the mail is 50 cents. A letter in the mail is maybe a buck. So it doesn't cost you an awful lot to connect with those people. We five mailings in a row to a prospect list of 3,800 people for one of our schools. And we get a trickle of people in. But again, at $1,600, if we got three enrollments from that mailing each time we did it, it's more than pays for itself.
Yeah.
So maybe that's maybe we're at four things. We've got raise your price, dramatically improve your service, expand your range of marketing activities, and do more stuff. And then once you get a lead, never let go. So what's another thing that would be on your 10 things you have to do in 2010?
Well, I think something that's you know, facing the economic reality that we all are facing, I think it's important that we very closely monitor expense structures in the school. Although most schools run pretty lean, I think that it's important to not, you know, be extraneously spending money on things that don't have a direct return on investment. At the same time, I think it's vitally important that you're spending money on expanding your education, expanding your skill sets, because that's what most people think that they should cut back first. Like they're looking around at their P&Ls and they're looking around at their you know, bank statements, and they're saying, well, you know, I'm spending $5,000 a year on seminars. Well, maybe you should cut that out. Well, see, the problem with that is the $5,000 a year you're spending on seminars is generating $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, $100,000 in return. So cutting that out is the worst thing you can do. What you should be looking at is how do I...
Well, let me interrupt you for a second. See, what I see, even a lot of decent but not truly excellent school owners doing, is spending an awful lot of money on their own technical training in martial arts curriculum.
Right.
So I'm already a fourth, fifth degree black belt master instructor. I'm running a school as a professional business, and I go out and I drop $10,000 to travel to Beijing or to Brazil or wherever it might be and train with the masters over there, and I take a week or 3 or 4 weeks off and I go do that. Well, if that's your hobby, so if that's what you're collecting net profit for, so rather than buy a Porsche or travel to Hawaii, you like to train, you know, travel to Beijing and train, then that's fine. However, if you're thinking of that as a legitimate business enhancement, it doesn't have anything to do with improving your school, truly. I mean, what we forget is almost all of the improvements that we need to improve the profitability of our school is what happens with a student in the first year to get them to the second year. It's not about you've trained for 15 years and it's moving your own personal technical knowledge up the next 3 or 4 notches on the next technique or training with the, you know, the Beijing demo team or whatever it might be. And so when you look at it, almost all martial artists over-concentrate on the technical aspect of their own training and of their art, and under-concentrate on what it truly takes to run an excellent school. So they don't spend peace of mind searching on the internet, tape sets or CD sets and DVD sets on how to truly become a master teacher. And they don't spend time, effort, and money in the same formats to truly become a master of all the different ways that they can market for their school. And they don't spend time, effort, and money to truly become a master of influence and persuasion to help uninitiated people join the school and people who have joined the school move up to a higher level of commitment and follow through to black belt. So when you're talking about expense structure, what you need to follow Benjamin Franklin's old thing: if you empty your purse into your mind, your mind will fill your purse. But it's got to be investing in training that's going to make you a better school owner, operator, and administrator, not things that are just going to make you a better athlete or a better, you know, slightly more knowledgeable martial artist at the upper fringe of the margin. Because ultimately, that stuff isn't going to move you very far. But yeah, I think it's important to make that distinction.
No, absolutely. And I think I was making that distinction by integrating the concept of what's the return on investment of that dollar. So exactly, if I decide to go over, you know, and train with the demo team in Korea, I mean, that's great. That's a great vacation for me, but what's the dollar for dollar return on investment of that money? Now, I know for me, every time I give Frank Kern money, you know, every time I buy the next DVD set that he puts out or the next CD set, or I send him money to get the, you know, new magnetic marketing update.
Yeah, well,
that generates revenue for me, you know?
Yeah, well, being at Extreme Success Academy, being in the Peak Performers or Inner Circle group, they're going to pay 100 times the investment or more, and they're going to truly grow their school to the next highest level. You know, and in terms of expenses, and it's not just that at times when money is flowing slowly, like in a recession like this, but at all times. You know, I've said over and over and over again is martial artists tend to over-invest on facilities. And having a bigger, more elaborate facility has never done anything for anybody to attract more students. Now, maybe if you're next to the movie theater, you're next to the high-end grocery store, that does. But just moving into an increasingly more elaborate facility and going from 3,000 square feet to 10,000 square feet, that doesn't bring new people in the door. So many, many, many school owners end up with their rent way out of whack. The other thing that they have a tendency to do is hire too many low-quality people and not enough high-quality people. And the thing we just had a conversation with all of our school owners about an hour ago was the fact that, I mean, it's a buyer's market right now for employees. I just ran a little $100 ad on Craigslist and have 30 resumes of which, you know, 12 of them are pretty good. And it's now time to, one, get rid of the hangers-on guys who, you know, never are going to rise to the occasion, truly be high performers. And at the same time, really get a small number of high performers in that are capable of making a very good living. So we've got to look at getting people who are really going to help take us to the next level. And, you know, no matter how emotionally difficult it is we've got to be cutting the guys at the, you know, at the bottom. You know, you go back to like, you know, the Jack Welch at GE thing was, you know, he was always cutting the bottom 10 or 20% of the company every year. And in our case, most of the single school operators anyway don't have a big staff, but they do have a tendency to have people who shouldn't be on payroll at all. And when they truly find somebody who's a gem, they have a tendency to kind of use and abuse that person until they go away because they're not properly compensating them.
It's easy to find yourself there in a business that promotes mostly from within. It's the whole Peter principle kind of, you know, revisited in our business, that we spent a lot of time educating someone to be a great student, and then we move them into a position as an instructor, and perhaps they don't have that skill set, or perhaps they don't develop that skill set adequately. And now
yeah.
we feel bad about getting rid of them because we spent so much time on them as a student. But in reality, you really do have to make decisions that are best for the business, not just make you feel better, you know.
Well, and many of us, and I think it's an admirable character trait. I feel the same way, but we know that our role with students is to really nurture them, develop them. We know that our role with our black belts is to support them and nurture them, and you know, and overlook their weaknesses and their difficulties to move them to the next level. But unfortunately, we carry that over to our staff. And you know, with your staff, there's three elements. There's, do they have the aptitude? Do they have the self-motivation and an interest? And then do they have the training? And we've got to be constantly evaluating them on all three of those things. And the training is our responsibility. We've got to be constantly teaching them better influence techniques, better podium skills, better speaking technique, enhancing their vocabulary, enhancing their knowledge of the systems we want implemented into the school, constantly giving them more drills and so forth. And from a motivation standpoint, I think we have to create a compensation system and a environment that doesn't sap their motivation from them. But ultimately, it is their responsibility to show up at the job wanting to be there and enthusiastic about it. And we've got to be very careful to, you know, to not spend so much time on feeling like we have to cheerlead that we tolerate the wrong person in there. The third thing is you know, the biggest problem I see across all schools is taking somebody who just frankly does not have the aptitude and is never going to be able to be a motivational, dynamic, charismatic head instructor, or is never going to be capable of really going out and doing community outreach marketing activities and to handle the pricing and sales objections and handling the enrollment process. And we keep hoping for, better results with them when, in fact, we're in the, trying to teach pick the thing motive. So it's very important early on to identify if you've got somebody in there with truly without the proper aptitude, and also to evaluate and make sure that they're truly motivated to perform at the high level, that we're not doing anything to get in the way of that. But, if we have to spend an awful lot of our time, cheerleading for them, it's probably the wrong person.
Yeah, there are big differences between, quote-unquote winners and losers. Mm-hmm. And there are significant personality differences between those people who are going to fry their heart out to get the result and other people who are ready to make an excuse at a moment's notice. And I think as soon as you get the indication that they're the latter rather than the former, you've got to start making some hard decisions fast, not slow.
Well, and that's right. And the management precept is always hire slow and fire quick. And as martial artists, as teachers, and most of the people we have on our staff have come up as our martial arts students, regardless is we put our instructor hat on and treat them like the white belt or the gold belt students in the school. And so we all have a natural tendency to do the opposite. We all have a tendency to hire quick, fire slow. And we've really got to fight that tendency. You've got to figure out if you've got somebody who's going to be results-oriented or who's going to have a lot of good excuses prior to bringing them on to the payroll. And you've got to figure out if you've got somebody who can add and subtract and be articulate and have a decent work ethic and be able to show up on time and master the sales processes before you hire them. The other thing is we've got to get our emotional selves out of the way and learn how to fire people when they first exhibit the traits that we know are going to lead them down the path of being a loser rather than continue to tolerate. In my own case, Toby, you've been intimately involved with this. We've tolerated some losers for way too many months earlier in the year and last year. Cleared house quite a bit in the first part of the year. In my case, it was a little bit of a liberating experience because we've had a couple who, as soon as they exhibited the traits that maybe last year would have festered for 4 or 5 months, after a couple of weeks, we've cut them free and are looking for their replacement. So it is something to be constantly vigilant of. And we're going to run out of time pretty quick, but we've hit some pretty good topics already. One was raise your price. Two is put the pencil to the paper and figure out how to dramatically improve the quality of your service to the students. Then expand your marketing efforts and your range of things that you're going to do. Next was make sure that you really, once you get a lead, you never let go of them. Then we talked about the expense structure, and pretty much everybody overspends on facility, underspends on quality people, hires too many people, and the third thing that I didn't hit was they are unwilling to spend adequately on marketing. And of course, you've got to monitor results on that, but really, pretty much everybody should be spending a lot more money than they are right now on marketing. I was just in an event in Las Vegas, and there was a very nice Korean gentleman teaches Hapkido in Chicago, and he was going through his school, and his school does about $80,000 a month, and every month, month in, month out, he spends about 15% of his gross on marketing, so he's spending $10,000 every month consistently, and grossing about $80,000, and my guess would be netting about $50,000. And Bill Clark and I had that conversation after talking to that gentleman for a while about it. And in almost all cases, I mean, it's difficult to do. And I got to tell you, if you're doing $1 million a month, it's more difficult to do than if you're doing $7,000 a month. Is in almost all cases, more money spent on higher quality activities to get students in will pay dividends. Toby, you have one or two other of the top 10 things you got to do for the new year to be successful?
Well, I mean, without, you know, reverting back to what's extremely basic, I think I've started to see in a lot of our, not necessarily in our coaching members, but in some of our people former members, I've seen a little bit of a shyness, I guess, away from the renewal process. So I think it's extremely important that you have a highly effective renewal process. You're moving at minimum 60%, more like the target to be 80% of all your entry-level students into a higher-level program within the first few months of their existence. There's almost all the revenue opportunity, but in reality, it's all the high-level service opportunity is within that group. So since you've spent all this time, money, energy, and effort acquiring a new customer, you really have to go back to your processes and make sure that you're maximizing the relationship with the customer. And that means moving them into your higher-level program quicker, not later. And moving them into a program that they're willingly, happily, and gleefully able to pay a premium for, if not double, then close to double what they were paying initially. And that deserves a lot of focus on the efficacy. So the amount of people you have participating in that program, like I said, at minimum 60%, the target's more like 80%.
Yeah. And the again, about an hour ago with our schools, I was reminding them that it really is an extension of the introductory process. Is you've got to be focused on from the first contact with your students. Is your mission isn't get them enrolled. Your mission is get them into the highest level program that you have in the school. And so it's important to think of it not as intro one, intro two enrollment, throw them over the wall to the instructor, and then several months later start talking to them again. But it's really should be more like it's an eight intro process where you do intro one, intro two, do the enrollment agreement, intro three, intro four, five, six, seven, eight, do the upgrade. Mm-hmm. And the easiest upgrades are the ones that are done the earliest, and it's all about knowing when they're ready, and that's you know, having a lot of communication with them and thumping them and making sure that the student is doing well in class and is enthusiastic in class. If it's a child, that the parents are actively engaged and enthusiastic about the process. So it's extremely important that you be really monitoring that and get that to happen very early on in the process.
Yeah, it's the fundamental difference between considering the enrollment being the end of the sales cycle or the beginning of the sales cycle. And in reality, it's not quite the beginning, but it's pretty close to it, you know?
Right. Yeah, I just think of it as an extended introductory process where you have basically two agreements.
Exactly.
They give you money and sign the agreement for the enrollment, and a few weeks later they give you money and sign the agreement for the upgrade. And it's a two-step enrollment process into the upgrade.
You know, which by the way, again, this is really like basic martial arts school operation 101, right? But, look, human nature is human nature. There's a certain amount of conditioning that we can do with students in classes to help them defeat pieces of the failure mechanism in human nature, right? We can teach people how to set goals, how to accomplish their goals. We can teach them how to be surrounded by other people who are on the same path that they are, et cetera, et cetera. But there are pieces of human psychology that we can't. And one of the pieces of human psychology that is really the reason that we've become the dominant species on the planet is that we always ask ourselves psychologically, what's next? Whatever we're doing, whatever we're currently doing right now, we're always kind of looking out for how can I improve on this? What's next for me? How can I expand on this? Right? It's not so much of the grass is always greener, but it's if I'm pretty happy with something right now, how much more happy would I be with something even better, right? And that's a natural instinct that humans have that really works to our advantage in a large school. And in reality, we have to be ready to answer the question, what's next? If we're not ready to answer the question, somebody else out in the marketplace. So when you have Johnny, who's a white belt, and maybe he's in class for 3 months or 4 months, and he starts to think to himself, what's next? See, either you're going to answer that question for him, or the gymnastics school down the street is going to answer that question for him, right? So I would rather it be us that answers the question, right? And that means, you know, Johnny, you're doing really well in the program so far. You know, how's everything going for you? Oh, it's great. You know, we're really enjoying it. We're really getting out of it what we expected to. We're getting so much more. Well, that's fantastic. You know, how much more do you think you would accomplish doing something like this? And you can show them that alternative. So this isn't about how to bait and switch somebody into something that they didn't want to begin with, or it's not about that. It's about helping them through that next process and really being able to serve them at a higher level than perhaps they were ready to understand at the first at the first enrollment conference.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, you know, Ms. Mallory, we probably have time for about 5 or 6 minutes worth of Q&A, if there is any. And otherwise, we have to ring off, and we're going to really put together a solid and complete the 10 things you have to do for the new year to share with everybody, starting off before the first of the year, and focus on making sure that all of our members are in the top 10% of the industry, not the bottom 80%.
Absolutely. So if you did have a specific question about anything we accomplished today, you can hit 6 on your phone and you'll be unmuted. And then again, hitting 6 again will mute you again. So you know you have to be careful of that. But any specific questions about where we're at right now? I think we do have a little bit of lead through background noise there, but
that's probably on my end actually.
Again, if you do have a specific question about where we're at today, you can just hit 6 on your telephone and you'll be unmuted, and you can fire away on the Q&As. I did have one email, Shawver, if you wanted to tackle that while they're in.
Yeah, go ahead.
It might be a good question for you specifically, but it's the demographic question. And
yeah.
this gentleman is resistant to charging premium prices because he thinks, quote, quote, everyone in his area charges $40 a month. And, I mean, that's basically his frame. That's what he's thinking right now. And
yeah.
Part of my response was, it's irrelevant what everybody else is charging. The only thing that's relevant is what you think your program's worth, what they think your program's worth, meaning the community or the customer. But maybe you could just, you know, quickly talk about the demographic argument.
Well, yeah. The first thing is everyone in my area is teaching blank or charging blank really misses a very, very, very important concept for what it is we're doing, right? Which is, you know, my response is always, and it's comes off as flippant and sarcastic, but is, who gives a shit what anybody else is charging? And again, we addressed this a little earlier, but it's if you're going to go buy toilet paper, you know, or Windex or anything that's a branded or a generic product. Yeah, you may compare between Target and Walmart and some other place. In my case, I don't, because I'm not all that sensitive to 5 or 10% difference on stuff like that. But, you know, you may compare and you may go to Walmart. That's why Walmart thrives. And as the economy has come down, even, you know, people in the top 10% income-wise are, you know, looking to save money on comparable products. But we're just not like that. And it really doesn't matter. I was having this conversation with an otherwise fairly intelligent school operator recently, and I said to him one simple thing. I said, well, how many of the last 40 enrollments that you did in your school had ever been to, talked to, or compared you with anybody else in your area or your city for martial arts lessons? Well, I mean, that's a pretty important question, right? Because if you're worried what everybody else is charging, the question might be is, do your prospects have any idea what they're charging? And next is, then do they care? Well, you know, his answer was about what I would have expected. And in our case, I think it's 3 to 5% ever talk to or even think about the fact that there's other people doing what we do. His answer was, I think, 7 or 8%. And so if you, let's say you cut your price in half because 1 out of 10 people are going to compare you with other people down the street, well, you've left 9 out of 10 paying a lot less than they would have paid otherwise, even if those 7 out of 10 are going to, or whatever it was, 7%, even if those 7% are going to choose somebody else because it's cheaper. And then the next question is you know, and I actually, a couple years ago, which was unusual, I actually had a series of people who were renewals who said, well, you're asking us for $20,000. You know, it dawned on us, we've never checked out anybody else who runs a school in the area. We're going to go check out the other guys. And I said, well, okay, fine, you know. I took out a map and I drove, you know, put stars where everybody else was and gave them a little fairly objective overview of what the other schools were. And I said, go talk to them. Now, don't just go talk to them about price. Go take a couple lessons. Go see what their program's all about. Go evaluate. Go talk to a few students and make a pretty thorough evaluation. Well, in each case, I had each of these people come back and they said exactly what he's saying, more or less. They said, well, we talked to school A, B, C, and D, and the school of those that we liked the best was this one, and that school is charging half of what you're charging. And my response, of course, was, well, do you want to take lessons with us or with them? And they said, well, we'd rather take lessons with you, but they're half the price. And so I said, what are you going to do? And they said, well, we'd like to take lessons with you, but we'd like to pay their price. I said, well, of course, that's not an option. So do you want to take lessons with us for what we're charging, or do you want to take lessons with them for what they're charging? And their answer was, well, we want to take lessons with you. Okay, it's fine. Do you want to do that with a check or a credit card? And see, part of, you know, number two on our list was make sure your program is high perceived value from the perspective of the customer. And truly, if you ever have somebody go and compare you with the five schools down the street, if they ever go and prefer that school, you should be shot on sight. Because, you know, unfortunately, and NAPNA has made a tremendous headway over 15 years, or a little more than that now, I guess, of elevating the quality of the industry, as have some other very highly successful school owners and consultants. But truly, we're still in an industry where most people are really horrible. And most of your competition isn't very good. And it should be rare, if ever, that a prospective student compares you with anybody else and prefers the other guy. And I know that was kind of a long answer to that, but, you know, the short answer is, who cares what anybody else charges?
Yeah. Well, yeah, but it brings into clarity, too. See, the Democrat, almost always when we hear the quote, but my area X quote, whenever we hear that, it's almost always that they're making an inaccurate assumption of their surroundings, number one. And number two, that they're assuming that everybody's running their finger down the yellow pages, calling everybody, comparing price. And it's almost never the case. And the second piece of that is, what, you know, there are always a huge chunk of your market, no matter where you're at, who prefer to have better, quote, nicer, quote, higher levels of service. I don't drive a Lexus because I really wanted the Toyota, but they didn't have any that day. I mean, I bought the Lexus because I wanted the Lexus, right? I mean, that's the car I wanted. I wanted the mirrors to go down when I backed up so I could see the corner, and I wanted the radar system, and I wanted the seatbelts and the airbags because I have a newborn that I'm putting in the back and all that stuff, right? I mean that's what I wanted. No one was being unethical or dishonest selling me the Lexus, right? That's the one I wanted. They had it there. The guy was good. I bought the car, you know? So you're not taking advantage of someone because your price is higher than the guy down the street. In fact, in my estimation, you're doing them a dramatic disservice if you allow them to go down the street and be misserved.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I think that's the assumption.
Yes, I mean all the way down the list, price is pretty low on most people's hierarchy of making the decision to buy or do something. And again, the only time it's on their hierarchy is when it's something that's easy to compare. Again, I use the example at the event recently, but you know, I just bought a 5 Series of 535 IX. BMW. So it's what that means is it's a 300 horsepower all-wheel drive mid-size BMW. It's not the high-end one, which doesn't have all-wheel drive, and it's not the smallest one. So in that case, if I can say I want a whatever the color is, pewter, with the saddle leather interior, with the sports seats, with the premium stereo package, with the all-wheel drive, current model year, and whatever the other list of options was this car had, if I can go through and create that checklist, well, there are that I know of, two pretty good quality BMW dealers here in town, and if they both have exactly the same car, then I can go back and forth and beat them up on price. Because now it's a comparable. It's, again, it's like, you know, buying a 32-ounce bottle of Windex. Well, they both got manufactured in the same plant. They both have the same stuff in them, and the same have the same packaging. And I can compare the grocery store, 7-Eleven, Target, and Walmart, and perhaps buy it the place that's cheaper. And in my case, if it was that choice, I'd probably buy it at Target rather than Walmart because I don't like walking in a Walmart. But in those cases, people can do a comparable. But our service isn't a comparable. Our service is more akin to hiring a CPA or hiring a chiropractor or hiring a neurosurgeon or looking at an attorney. And, you know, in several cases, like on the franchise side with us, you know, part of my decision was I wanted the expensive attorney, not the cheap one, because I wanted the guy who was going to do it right, and absent other criteria, I know the one that's, you know, most proud of themselves probably is pretty good. And sometimes what you do is a disservice by you let the student assume that you're not the best person doing this in town because you aren't the highest priced one in town.
Absolutely.
Well, I know we have to run. We've been about 90 minutes here. And I would recommend that we, remind everybody, one, about your event on Monday that they could still jump into if they had the wherewithal to do it. And two is about emailing us questions for our next call. Our next call will kick off the new year. And we're going to really have some new and exciting things in 2010 to make sure our members have more success than ever.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I can't let the cat out of the bag yet, but we actually have some really exciting new marketing strategies beginning the first of the year that we're going to be able to provide in a done-for-you format that you don't have to worry about hiring a professional copywriter for $20,000 to write you the letters and stuff like that. We've got some really interesting leverage for you on that deal. So we'll talk about that next year. But yeah, next Monday we do have our member appreciation event down here in Clearwater, Florida. And you can go to natmaseminar.com, and you can register there. And if you're a member, which of course you are, you can actually go to natmaseminar.com/member.html and you can register as a member, or you can just call Bob at the office at 727-540-0500. And it's turning out to be a great event. It's going to be a very intimate setting. We're really going to go through the most successful business models that are working in today's market and the business models that are failing at a high rate in today's market, and have some real concrete, you know, actionable marketing steps for January 1. By the time you leave the room, it should be a whole new universe for you. So really look forward to seeing a bunch of folks there. I know we've got a good number of folks who are already registered, and I think I have to get the next size meeting room up. Otherwise, we'll be pretty tight on space. But so I've got just a couple of seats left to fill. So you may want to go to natmaseminar.com/members.html, and that'll get you registered, or just call Bob at the office.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Elroy, and we're going to ring off for today and remind everybody to email me or you with questions for next time, StephenOliver@NAMNA.com or TobyMilroy@NAMNA.com.
Absolutely. Sounds great. Thanks, guys.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir.